Before we begin, I'd like to welcome to the bench for his first oral argument, one of many, Justice Stevens from Hamilton County. In our first case, 2022-0058, Mary Ann Diller versus Phyllis Diller, for the appellant, Ashley Doty. Good morning.
Kennedy, and may it please the court, thank you to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This is a case of first impression regarding the interpretation of Ohio's anti-lapse statute codified at section 2107.52. To start our discussion, it is important to note that 2107.52 is a remedial statute intended to be liberally construed to advance its purpose. Codified at section 1.11, remedial laws and all proceedings under them shall be liberally construed in order to promote their object and assist the parties in obtaining justice.
But how is that helpful? Because you first have to understand what it means to understand what its object is. So to me, to say something is remedial so it's going to be liberally construed means pretty much nothing.
I think you have to look at the purpose of the statute to make sure that the testator's intent is being found here.
But don't we look at the language to figure out what the intent of the statute is? So doesn't that...
The underlying purpose of the remedial statute is to...
But how would we know what the purpose is except for what it says?
Understood. I think perhaps a further reading of what the history of the statute was originally and what the changes were in the statute would allow us to understand what the meaning was.
Are we really bound by 1.11? Is this court bound by that?
Well, it's a assistance to help you interpret the other statutes in the.
Are we bound to be told by the legislature how to interpret a statute?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe you are. The issue before this court is whether the anti-lapse statute applies to protect the primary device in a will. Below, the Mercer County Probate Court found that the anti-lapse statute does apply to a primary devise, and the Third District Court of Appeals during appeal then found that the primary devise is no longer protected by the anti-lapse statute. Since the decision of the Third District Court of Appeals, 2107.52 has again been amended. Just last week, the governor has signed Senate Bill 202, which amended the anti-lapse statute to clarify that it does now apply to a primary device. I think the confusion...
Counselor, when you say it now applies to a primary device, are you saying it didn't?
I am not. The confusion created by the decision in the Third District Court of Appeals made the legislature clarify the language in its statute. Perhaps it brought to light some confusion that could be created by that language.
So you're just saying... So you're not saying it now, you're saying it always applied,
it did,
but the change
apply to
was clarified
device.
With the amendment.
Okay. Yes, it's clarified. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. So going back to the rules of basic statutory interpretation, looking at basic statutory interpretation will result in finding that a primary device remains protected not only before 2012, but in the 2012 statute and then post-2012. Careful reading of the statute will reveal that the language contained in the statute never actually narrows its application to only the defined devices contained in that statute. The start of the definition section in that statute states as used in this section. It does not state as applied. It does not state that this section may only apply to a device as defined in this section. It means if you find the word devise in this section, you must use one of these definitions. We can do that and still apply this statute to a primary device. The operative portions of the statute are found in Section B, specifically Section B2, a literal reading of Section B2 states that a substitute gift is created whenever there is not a class gift. Starting at B2 and then going to B2A, if you break that operative section of the statute down into elements, we meet every element. A primary device meets every element in that portion of the statute. You can break that down into elements, and even if the definition stands, you would still be able to apply that statute to a primary devise. In fact, the only place where the word devise is located in the operative portion of that statute is in section B2A, which states if the devise is not in the form of a class gift. No devise is in the form of a class gift in this case. There was no class gift in this case, and that is the only portion of the operative clause in the statute that states that the word devise. There's applying a step-by-step analysis of these sections allows the statute to apply so long as all of the other elements are met. Here they are.
Counselor, Mr. Pinno, the testator, died after the 2012 amendments, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what if it was his, so he could have changed his will because his brother had already passed.
Yes, correct? Your Honor.
What if it was his intention to have the primary devise to his deceased brother lapse?
There's a potential that that was what the intention was of the testator, and we have to determine what not only what the intention was of the testator, but the real reason that we're here in front of you is to determine what the intention was of the legislature in enacting the statute and then following through with the statute the way that it should have been followed. Therefore, a primary devise should remain included as a protected devise within the anti-lapse statute because there's no indication that the statute intends to remove such protection. Should this court read 2107.52 to determine that there is a question as to whether the statute applies to a primary devise or to only an alternative devise or a devise in a class gift or a power of appointment, it's necessary to then consider the absurdity doctrine and review the legislative intent behind the enactment of the 2012 version of the statute. In State versus Parker, this court stated that the absurdity doctrine is a limited exception to be applied when unambiguous language of a statute would yield an unintended result. When the plain language of the statute has an obviously unintended result caused by a technical error or a ministerial error, the absurdity doctrine may be used to remedy the issue.
Do you think that the 2023 amendments to the statute demonstrate or can be used to demonstrate that perhaps this supports the absurdity doctrine in that the legislature's signaling we never meant this?
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe that if you look into the legislative history of the 2023 amendment to the statute, you'll see that the initial discussions of amending that statute occurred after the Third District Court of Appeals decision. I think that that's helpful to indicate that the legislature found that the Third District Court of Appeals decision was not in line with what the intended purpose of the statute was, and so they sought to fix that issue legislatively for cases going forward, and then they also made that fix retroactive so that it would fix anything post-2012.
Should this court affirm the decision of the Third District now that the 2023 amendment will be in place and it is retroactive? Does your client have any remedy?
So the client does have a remedy, but there are potential unanswered questions if that happens. There was a recent filing in this case which indicated there might be some constitutional issues that would be argued. And the basis of the decision made in this case, whether a primary devise would apply or whether it would not apply, would then be very determinative of whether the constitutionality issue would be available for any further decisions.
Should we remand this to the Third District and tell them to take into account the new law?
No, Your Honor. And the reason for that is because I think either way the Third District is going to determine it, there would be arguments for that new law. Either it should be applied and a primary device should apply, or we've had some foreshadowing into the arguments from the other side that if the court decides a primary device does apply, then Mrs. Diller would appeal that decision and claim that there was a constitutionality issue with the revisions to the statute, which would lead us back up through the appellate courts.
But don't we usually allow lower courts to look at issues first? Why not send it down? There's a new statute. We have new facts. I mean, this is before we weigh it up.
Your Honor, I believe that this specific decision will be fully briefed again in that decision, even if we were to go back to the probate court, because ultimately
why would this decision be fully briefed again at the probate court?
Because whether or not there's a constitutionality issue depends on whether or not there was a primary devise. Should this court find there a primary devise is covered by the 2012 version of the statute, Panucci and Mr. Pinto were to receive those items. Mrs. Diller has given us some foreshadowing that she will appeal the case because of a constitutionality issue, claiming she had a vested interest in that property and it was taken away by the statute.
And why not let the trial court figure that out first and then it can all come up here? I mean, wouldn't that make a lot more sense than just to decide this issue and then send it back for another issue and come back here again?
A decision by this court could remedy the issue entirely before we go back to the Third District Court of Appeals, but
if this case at this point involves no factual issues, just legal issues, which it seems to me that it does, would there be a benefit to asking for a further briefing on aside from the constitutional issues that are potentially out there that could be a separate action, is there any benefit to further briefing based on the enactment of the new law?
I don't think it's necessary, Your Honor, for a further briefing based on the enactment of the new law. All of the facts are before the court, and the new law, we need to decide this based on the 2012 version of the law, which is what is fully briefed before the court. The new law can act as a guide to further the argument that 2012 version was potentially confusing, and we know what now the legislative intent has been clarified.
Well, if that's the case, isn't that a reason it should be remanded? Because that argument was never presented to the lower courts.
Right. It was unavailable because of the new statute has just been.
Well, I mean, there's certainly an argument that the new statute shows that the legislature recognized that the effect of the old statute was that a primary devise didn't apply. That argument was never heard by any of the lower courts. So isn't that another reason it should go back to them so that they can consider that? We will be considering that for the first time here otherwise.
That may be a good reason to go back to the probate court and rebrief that issue, although I think in the effort of judicial economy and making a determination based on the facts that are already before this court and all of the efforts that have gone into getting to this point, at this point, perhaps it would be beneficial to the expedience of the case to make a decision today.
You're into your rebuttal time.
Okay. I'll save reserve for rebuttal. Thank you.
For appellees, Mr. John Willimowski. I've been told you're splitting time with counsel Paul Howe. You are taking 9 minutes and he's taking six.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. My name is John Willimowski and I represent the appellee in this case, Phyllis Diller, who's the co-executor of the estate of Theodore Pinto. I'll be focused here today on the first issue before the court, which deals with whether Ohio's anti-lapse statute applies to a primary device, such as the one found in item 2 of testator's will. Paul Howell, who represents appellee Mary Ann Diller, will focus on the second issue, which deals with the absurdity doctrine. Again, given the questions just given to opposing counsel, I think it's important to respond to a few of those and clarify a few issues before we get into argument today. We absolutely believe, which is why we filed the motion last week, that this case is a candidate for a Rule 7.10 dismissal is improvidently accepted. Unfortunately, since the new statute has come about and there's been no opportunity to brief that statute below, there's the opportunity, as Justice Bruner pointed out, potentially to brief that issue. And if the court were to decide this case, on the merits of that issue and look at it. We'd ask to obviously have an opportunity to be heard, but procedurally, we believe it would be better to dismiss the case as improvidently accepted, remand it back to the trial court, and then look at the application of the recently enacted 2023 version.
Is there any wiggle room under the new law? Isn't the issue resolved? There's one issue.
So not necessarily. So if you look at the redefinition in 2107-52A3, where it defies is defined, in the 2012 version that was in effect at the time of testator's death in 2019, there's only one section. Its device means an alternative device, class gift, power of appointment. However, the recent changes are a device includes a primary device, class gift, and power of appointment. And if you look at that, then there's a subsection B that says, to the extent that is constitutionally permissible under Article 2, Section 28, again, we need to figure out the legislature had the power of the pen. They declined to use that and define where that line was. It's now to this court, well, eventually probably this court, to decide where that line is drawn, but we'd ask the opportunity to brief the lower courts first in normal judicial process. So with that said, I don't believe it really does get rid of the issue in its entirety because, again, you got to understand that in 2019, the testator passed. 3 years later, the legislature changed it with retroactive effect. And if you look at the constitutional issue that we'd be prepared to raise, it would be at the time the testator passed away, that legally vested based upon the statute that was enacted at the time. So when they were legally vested with their interest under the will, although it hadn't been changed by a certificate of transfer, when a testator passes away, the legal interest transfers and vests upon their death. And so at that point, you're taking a vested property interest away from someone retroactively 3 years later after they've had no opportunity to change their will to ensure that that effect is shown as to who they would like the item to actually go to and what law would actually apply, as the testator is presumed to know the law in effect at the time of their death. They couldn't possibly know the law in effect after their death. Now, a couple of other procedural matters that, again, I think reinforce our request to dismiss this as improvidently accepted is that to get to the matter here before the court today, appellants have to argue that their anti-lapse statute is ambiguous and that because it's ambiguous, the court needs to look at legislative history. Unfortunately, if you look at their prior pleadings, that's the first time they've made this argument is before this court. And in fact, if you look at their pleading, specifically their counterclaim in the trial court at paragraph 12, they in fact specifically plead that the statute is unambiguous. So their whole case kind of hinges on the ambiguity, but if you look procedurally, they've actually specifically pled that the case is unambiguous.
Let me ask you a question about the if we were to apply the 2023 statute as sort of support for the absurdity doctrine and decide in favor of the appellant, wouldn't we be in effect, because of the 2023 statute, just performing error correction for this one case?
I would think it wouldn't necessarily be error correction for this one case. I would note to the court that to the extent the legislature is signaling anything in the 2023 statute, I think they signal two things. One, they signal that the 2012 statute doesn't include a primary device. Otherwise, they'd have no reason to change the statute. And I think
Hold on. Why wouldn't the reason be to clarify? Because what you're arguing is then the statute there is no protection for a primary device under the anti-lapse statute at all.
Right, because the legislature previously used the term means, which is an exclusive definition. They've now switched it to the term includes to show that they would like it to include that.
But why can't it be, it's now that this decision has come out of the Third District, which misconstrued that definition, we need to clarify it?
Because I don't believe, given your typical lexical and stipulative definitions of means and includes, that it's necessarily a clarification, but a straightforward application.
If the definition said device also means?
That they're changing it to do that, but they're recognizing.
No, they're saying includes.
Right, they're saying includes now. Previously, they said means. So
right,
they're saying they disagree with the
but
opinion.
If it said also means.
Right, But the concern then becomes the retroactivity of the effect, and I think it signals again that they're changing that provision. I think it's also important to note, if you look at the revised code section for 5808.19, the anti-lapse statute for trusts, the very same language, no primary devise, or then in that term they don't use primary devise, they specifically use the term future interest. They didn't put a primary future interest back into that section either.
Oh, but was there any indication that the General Assembly intended to amend the statute to exclude a primary devise, or that the purpose of amending the statute in 2012 was to address the trust issues, the anti-lapse applying to trusts?
Right, and I think it's important to note that I think they did that. The only indication that you can see is through their use of the word means. Now, if you look at the Legislative Service Commission's document, as appellants have asked you to look at, I don't believe there's an indication either way, there's not an explanation whether they use the term means or includes or why they decided to do that.
But your position is they could have just decided out of the blue, we're going to exclude primary devices.
You're right. My position is that the legislature, to get to the legislative intent and look at the legislator's intent, the statute first has to be ambiguous. It's not. It says means instead of includes. And second, to get there, you would look at the Legislative Service Commission's. If you look at this court's decisions kind of going all the way back to Meeks versus Papadopoulos, which is the first of the three cases cited by appellants, usually the courts in those cases are looking for, it could be A or it could be B, because we have two separate sections that we're trying to remedy, and the Legislative Service Commission document says A or B and gives an indication of which of the two would be most appropriate. We don't have that here in front of the court. We have simply that nothing. It doesn't say whether A or B. It's a negative presumption found within there.
When you stated the new language to the 2023 amendment, and I can't get in front of me, you said that it now says includes and primary devise.
Correct.
So primary devise has been inserted in the new definition, not just includes was changed?
Correct. So they put includes and they specifically named primary devise. Yes.
So if we actually reach a decision in this case, how many people are going to benefit from our decision because now we have a statutory change? That's why I asked you about error correction.
Right. I believe the question becomes, if we get to the constitutionality issue, any individual who has passed from the 2012 enactment of that statute to anybody who has passed prior to the enactment of the 2023 version, individuals that could take under that version of the statute would have a vested property interest. So I don't know exactly how many cases, but from 2012 to when the enactment of the new statute would be anyone who might be able to take or not take under the language of the 2012 version. So it's when the testator has passed between the enactment of the 2012 version and the 2023 version.
But wouldn't most of those estates be settled?
Some of them may be settled. Some of them may still be active. This estate's from 2019. Again, once they've been settled, that means there's no mechanism for them to go back and relook at that and revisit that, because it's already been ordered on and your time for appeal has already been through. But for the other cases that are open, there's vested property interests at stake with the 2023 version.
That is if they're not taking as a primary interest and it becomes residual.
Right. So in this case, if item two of testator's will lapses, then it falls into the residuary clause. A residuary clause is Mary Ann Diller and then Mary Ann Diller and then John Penno. John Penno's two children would take in his place there, because that is an alternative device. It was first granted in item two, now in item three. So effectively it would be half to Mary and half to John Penno's surviving children under the 2012 version of the anti-lapse statute. And I apologize, I don't see the time that I was told to be on the podium. Am I?
So you're into Mr. Howe's time.
Okay, I apologize. I'll cede the rest of my time to Mr. Howe. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Howe.
Good morning. Chief Justice Kennedy, may it please the court. I'm going to limit my remarks this morning to the second proposition of law, which is how the use of the absurdity doctrine is inappropriate in this particular case. The essence of the absurdity doctrine, or the absurd result exception, is essentially that if you apply the plain language of the statute, then there is an obviously unintended result that no reasonable person could approve of. However, in this particular case, I want to go through a few things that indicate why this is not a mistake in the first place, either in its result or as to what the legislature intended. The previous statute that was in effect at the time the General Assembly amended the 2012 version of the statute was the 1992 version. And a review of that indicates to you pretty quickly, it's two paragraphs long, and it's somewhat garbled. The long second paragraph is somewhat hard to follow. But nowhere in there will you find a definition of devise. And it certainly didn't distinguish between a primary or an alternative devise. However, in 2011, the General Assembly completely repealed that statute. And when they repealed the statute, they went through what's obviously a pretty detailed examination of the subject matter and obviously what they intended to enact. First of all, the new statute in 2012 includes extensive definitions, including what a devise means. And I also find it telling that the title of the statute, the 2012 version, is definitions. I think the focus of the enactment was first on, the General Assembly was trying to, obviously by the virtue of the language they use, trying to define what the terms mean. So it's our position that there is no mistake to begin with, let alone an obvious decision in how, or an obvious unintended result that no person could approve just by virtue of looking at the structure of the statute, the wording they use, and how detailed of an examination they did before they passed it. Now, the defendant argues also about the application of this doctrine to trust. Well, trust, the language in the trust section is similar to that as far as an alternative device and an alternative future interest. That's evidence of consistency. In other words, if they hadn't gotten it right in 2012, whenever they created the trust code or they amended the trust code, they did the same thing there regarding excluding primary devices for testamentary gifts or devices to individuals. I also want to address the issue about what a reasonable person could conclude this statute means, the 2012 or the 2019 version. It's not unreasonable for the General Assembly to exclude primary devices to individuals from the ALS coverage. And this is just what I think is a possible purpose that they might have had, not saying that there's any express indication of that other than the language of the statute eliminating primary devices. First of all, if a testator states a primary device to one individual in his or her will, and it's to that person and that person and nothing more, by what he has written in his will, he has said that it's only to go to a single named person, by what he's written. However, if he or she makes a primary device to that same individual, but makes an alternate device in case that primary devisee is deceased before him, then he's already made an indication that in writing, in his will, that he wants that property to go beyond the first devisee. So it's not unreasonable for anyone or the General Assembly in limiting the scope of the application of the ALS to exclude primary devices, but to allow it for alternate devices. See, what would happen, there's a significant difference in the first scenario, because in the first scenario, in the will, the testator expressly in writing wanted a particular gift to go to a particular individual. And he didn't say anything further about what happened to it after this person died. However, in the second scenario, he has expressed in writing an intent to pass property that by devise beyond one person to survivors. So in that instance, I think what the legislature could reasonably be assumed to do is they're saying that we're not going to just automatically assume that a primary devise that states nothing else, that the testator wanted it to go to anybody else.
Thank you. I'm sorry that the timer seems not to be working on the podium, and they're going to look at that, but your time's up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a couple of brief points given the appellee's argument. First, I wanted to point on the purpose of amending the anti-lapse statute. If you go back and look at the legislative history, you can see that when the 2012 version of the anti-lapse statute was created, the initial purpose was to create an anti-lapse statute that applied to trusts specifically, because anti-lapse had previously applied to trusts, then did not, and they were trying to codify the anti-lapse statute for trust purposes. The reason that the anti-lapse statute was then revised as it applied to wills was an attempt, clearly, to make the two anti-lapse provisions similar. They used similar language, they made the similar terms in there, so they just simply created the trust version, copied over into the wills version, and the issues in the language followed from one to the other. I also want to point to the purpose of the anti-lapse statute being to protect the intent of the testator, and the appellees argue that they believe the legislative intent with the revision to the statute was to make a testator more apt to make alternative devises in their wills. And while we would all prefer that that be the case and that we not have to fall back on these provisions, the whole purpose of this remedial statute is to take care of issues when there is a forgotten alternate given. No alternate is given in the will.
But Counselor, shouldn't that be a difference or a distinction that we draw, that the statute, the anti-lapse statute, is designed to protect a devise such that it doesn't sheet to the state or pass through intestate succession or something if there is no alternative devise? But in this case, since there was with the residual property, then doesn't that further the purpose of the statute?
This particular case, there is an alternative devise, but this court's decision is going to apply in situations where there may be a will where there's only one devise, that you've given all of your property to your one favorite sibling, and if the court was to decide that 2012 version did not apply to a primary devise, then that devise would lapse, and you would then pass everything by intestacy. That one favorite sibling's family would not receive.
So the wording of the word devise and its meaning would apply wholesale even when there wasn't a residual or a alternative device.
Yeah, sure.
One follow-up, if I may. In the context of trusts, this 2012 statutory anti-lapse change, does it apply differently? Does it shed any light on what the legislature's intent? I mean, does it work differently in the trust setting than it does in the will setting, so that we might be able to glean some kind of legislative thought there?
There's actually also a error or a confusion in the language that's included in that trust statute as well, where it again includes a future interest instead of the specific current interest and also a future interest. That's what followed through into this will provision, where whomever was drafting the will anti-lapse statute included only an alternate devise in it instead of including a primary devise as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement and you'll receive a decision. Thank you so much.